Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. Science research can only take you so far. Eventually, you have to do something with it. Actually, fulfilling some of the dreams of researchers at the edge of science requires the cooperation of counties, entire countries, and even the world. Well, in this country, decisions get made at the Palace of Westminster, even though maybe decisions is a bit generous. But how do members of Parliament and the House of Lords get their info? Well, with me today is Jack Miller, who's an advisor for the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology. And this is the body responsible for keeping our politicians informed about the bleeding edge of science and really turning science into policy. Welcome,
quite,
Jack.
Quite a big responsibility there, isn't it?
Well, there you go. I mean, so often on this show we have on people who are scientists. They end up doing a lot of research, but this is slightly different. This is like another aspect of actually science in life. How did you get into this role? What's your background?
I have an undergraduate background in physics, so I've had a bit of experience in a kind of research environment. And as I was coming towards the end of my undergraduate, I thought, you know, this is great. I'm enjoying this research, but I'd really like to. You know, I'm very interested in energy and climate change. I always have been. And I was thinking, well, what can I do that's got the most impact? Really, I was working in a kind of an optics lab during my undergraduate, and I thought this is you know, interesting stuff, and we're working with like quantum computing and stuff, but it's not really what I think has the most impact. So I moved into a kind of more policy space when I did some postgraduate education at SPRU down in University of Sussex, energy policy, and then I went on to do started a PhD at least in science and technology policy studies. So I've been aware of what POST, or the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology, I've been aware of what we do for a little while now, and I kind of just moved into this space about a year and a half ago now. So yeah, it's been, right, so been an interesting road.
Getting towards an expert then. Well,
I hope so.
So before we dive into exactly what POST does, we're just going to kick things off with your first song. And you've chosen Everybody Loves the Sunshine by Roy Ayers Ubiquity.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Any particular reason for this one?
Because we're in the middle of an endless summer, I think, and it's and I am embracing this with open arms, open, slightly sunburnt arms. Yeah, I think it's just it's kind of just summed up my life for the last 2 or 3 months, and I think I wanted to share it today.
All right, well, here it is. So that was Roy Ayers with Everybody Loves the Sunshine. So, Jack, let's start at the beginning. What exactly is the role of POST, or the Parliamentary Office for Science and Technology?
Yeah, we're not the post office.
No.
So POST, in a nutshell, we provide kind of impartial scientific advice to members of the UK Parliament. So we will look, well, particularly issues in science and technology that have a particular public policy focus, right? So MPs, peers, or members of the House of Lords. So we look at, we serve both the Commons and the Lords, as it were. And we provide, I think the official line is independent, balanced, and accessible analysis of public policy issues related to science and technology.
Well, there you go. Simple as that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But so you advise Parliament, right? Not just the government.
Yeah.
This is a Parliament-wide. So the government is just a small number of MPs, but anyone, any member of Parliament can come to you.
Absolutely, and... yeah. And this is maybe a bit of a common misconception, which I should clear up once and for all. Parliament is made up of the House of Commons and the House of Lords, or members thereof. The Commons is the 600-odd MPs who are elected in democratic elections. Lords is made up of peers who are either, well, generally appointed. So, and they come from any political background, so they're any political party. And yeah, we advise any member of the Commons or Lords. Whereas, you know, government is, well, it's, I think it's about 90 odd MPs and some peers who are formed from the party that have the majority of the day, kind of thing.
And so in this kind, you're kind of impartial. You're not really a political leaning.
Absolutely impartial. Yeah, I mean it's. You know, the nature of advising members of any political background is that we have to be impartial, and we are, and it's, you know, our integrity rests on our impartiality. So we don't make any recommendations, for example. We just kind of synthesize research and expertise from loads of different areas. And we kind of essentially like kind of translate it, you could say, into a plain English format that...
Something that's a bit more digestible.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So how big is this team? And do you all, do all the members have a specialism or speciality? Yeah. Or do you all, you know, do different things?
Yeah, okay. So Post is, I mean, we have, I think it's 10 advisors split across four teams. So we have physical sciences and ICT, biological sciences and health, social science, and then environment and energy. And I'm the energy advisor. All of our advisors have a background in that field, so they know the field relatively well. Often they'll have come from maybe a research background, or, you know, the nature of the work is that we've got one foot within academia and one foot within policy circles. So, you know, often they might have policy experience as well. Like, you know, I've done a bit of postgraduate education with policy. One or two of our advisors are former civil servants, for example. But everyone will generally have experience in the academic world, so we'll know the language to speak both to academics and to policymakers as well. And we collaborate and stuff as well to some extent. You know, science is increasingly interdisciplinary, and you know, those four teams that I mentioned, you know, science doesn't fit within these nice little silos, particularly, you know.
Yeah. So obviously we're talking about a huge spectrum here of lots of different things pulling from different disciplines. How do you decide what to present to Parliament? Because you've got a whole host of things to do.
Yeah,
how does that process happen?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, I mean, maybe just a bit of background. Our primary output, if you will, are these post notes, as they're called. They're these four-page kind of policy briefings. We'll have a post note on a specific issue. So we released one recently. Well, in the energy team, we did one on small modular nuclear reactors. We've done one on overseas electricity interconnection. All of the topics of the post notes are approved by a board that we have. So we have a board of, I think it's 10 MPs, maybe four or five, six members of the House of Lords, and then four external academic like professors as well. And people are appointed to the board because they have maybe a scientific or a technical background, for example. You know, they have some expertise. And so we will essentially pitch topics to them. We'll say, okay, so this topic is timely because of X, Y, and Z. So, you know, a topic might be timely for a whole host of different reasons. So, you know, there might be, the science might have moved on quite suddenly recently. There might be new understandings maybe. Maybe it's a new topic entirely with a policy relevance. So, off the top of my head, e-cigarettes, for example, we published a note on e-cigarettes 2 years ago. When that was still relatively new, you know, it kind of came out of nowhere, really. And so members were saying, "Well, what does this mean? You know, what does this mean for health?" There's conflicting, maybe discussions in the media around what the health implications of this are, and we need someone to translate this for us, kind of thing.
Right. So I think we're going to move on to your second song. You've chosen Queens of the Stone Age.
Yeah.
I Sat by the Ocean. Again, any reason for this one?
Well, I mean, so I saw Queens of the Stone Age for the first time maybe a month or two ago, and they were just phenomenal, and I've been waiting to see them for about 15 years, and they're just an incredible band. And it was quite a tricky choice because, you know, there are four or five different songs that I could have chosen, but, you know, this I think has everything that Queens embody. So yeah, enjoy.
Yeah.
was Queens of the Stone Age with I Sat by the Ocean. So we were talking before, Jack, about these post notes that you write, and this is your primary output of how you communicate with Parliament. How do you get into the process of writing these notes? You know, where do you draw from, and who do you talk to?
Okay, so there's two foundations of the research that goes into a post note. Just to emphasise again, you know, they're not novel academic research, so they are kind of we do them with a short literature review. It's nowhere near kind of a systematic review or anything that on that kind of scale, because we produce these in generally around 3 or 4 months, and it's one or two people working on these. So we're quite limited in the resource, and they're quite kind of reactive sometimes. So, you know, so they're a short literature review, and then we really rely on the expertise of stakeholders. So we go and we speak to maybe 20 or 30 per note, and, you know, bearing in mind this is a 4-page note.
Yeah.
That's quite a lot of quite a large number of interviews to be having for these post notes, and then so we do the research and we start basically drafting, and often it'll be often the research is done by a postgraduate fellow, we call them. Usually a PhD student will come and work with us for 3 months. Maybe I can talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah, no, please.
And then you know, they might have an advisor kind of supervising them, and so we have a drafting process. And then we have a couple of uniquely for parliamentary research publications, we have a couple of stages of peer review as well.
Right.
So we have an internal one first. So, you know, some of the advisors will sit round and we'll go through line by line and be like, okay, looking at this and looking at the language and all of this. And then we'll have an external peer review process as well, which is we send it to most of the people that we've interviewed. So you've got a 4-page note and you send it to 20 or 30 people, and you can end up with about 200 or 300 comments.
Ideas.
And, you know, sometimes it's people are trying to, you know, get their hobby horse into the note, or, you know, people are saying, no, I fundamentally disagree with this. You need to change it all. And so it can be a tricky process weighing all that up sometimes.
Yes, I mean, it's very similar to the process of writing a scientific paper. But it doesn't read like a scientific paper. It reads, you know, like something different.
Mm.
Are there any kind of language points or phrases that you try and minimize and avoid? And what do you try and go for?
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, if you read one of the post notes, which are all publicly available, by the way, available on our website. They have quite a distinctive kind of linguistic style. We have a post-house style, if you will. So we are trying to communicate what are often quite complex issues to a lay audience. So members might not necessarily have a technical background. They often come from maybe a legal or a business kind of background. And so we really have to kind of de-jargon a lot of the scientific research in particular. You know, we might be talking about something that's quite technically complex, and we've got to try to explain that to a lay audience. And so we're removing jargon. We're very concise in the use of language, you know, very short sentences. And it's really a very different writing style to academia, which, you know, academics aren't really known for their concision sometimes.
No, they're really not. I mean, reading, part of the thing is, the difficult thing of reading academic papers is just learning to understand how people formulate ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that, you know, that's part of our job as well, to be able to try and understand the language of academics within our field. We just have this very concise use of language, and as well, we mentioned impartiality earlier. I mean, I'll just emphasize it again, we're not making recommendations in this. We're trying to use as objective language as we possibly can. So it's a lot of different aspects about the language in
That's an interesting point, and that's one of the things that I was actually really interested about, which is How do you balance the idea of scientific consensus and viewpoints? You know, you're saying some of these people be like, oh, this is completely wrong. Mm. You know, this is not right. And the really at the edges of science, it really is not the scientific consensus and the viewpoint of an individual scientist is not the same.
Yeah.
So how do you balance that? I mean, we can take an extreme example of something like climate change in the US, which is presented as a balanced thing where there are two sides, where there's really a scientific consensus.
And
so how do you present that?
Well, I mean, so yeah, it's a really tricky one, and climate change is a particular one, obviously. I mean, we're quite lucky in the UK in that we have a kind of political consensus that about the need to tackle climate change, and, you know, the that it's caused by anthropogenic means, human-caused means. But, you know, broadly speaking, if there is a scientific consensus, then we will try to communicate that. And then obviously, as you... So on a big, broad climate change level, there's scientific consensus on that. And then as you dig down into that, into some of the kind of the intricacies of the topic, maybe sometimes there might be uncertainty or mixed evidence maybe around certain bits or certain bits within that area kind of thing. So,
yeah, and kind of in the same vein, you know, these things, a lot of research that you're maybe presenting is not ready for something. You know, you're actually, this is quite tentative. There are people, there are still lots of things to be worked out. Is there a threshold of evidence that it gets to before it's presented in one of these notes? Or can they be presented as kind of, well, this is the direction we're moving in. Maybe there's a bit more research to be done here.
Yeah.
Just how open-ended are these?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think what it boils down to is why would a member of the UK Parliament be interested in this topic? You know, how does it affect everyday citizens, if you will, you know? And so it's a tricky question to answer, and it's very contextual, right? And it's, you know, like I said, it might be the evidence might shift dramatically, and which has implications in a public policy kind of sense. You know, so it's quite a roundabout answer, but it's very contextual. It depends massively on the actual, on the topic itself, I think.
Yeah, it seems like quite a hard task. I'm surprised you can do it in 3 to 4 months to get one of these notes out. Well, let's move on to your next song. You've got one thing, Anne-Marie.
Yeah, so you might notice this is a bit of a mixed bag today. Yeah, I wanted to mix it up a little bit, go for a bit of classic kind of mid-2000s R&B. This is one of these songs, you know, everyone's been there. It's 4 p.m, you've maybe got a deadline, the coffee's stopped working, and you need a kind of bit of an energy injection. And, you know, colleagues of mine will tell you that I have been known to unashamedly just stick this on repeat and help blast out a draft of a note or something. So... Yeah, this is Anne-Marie, One Thing.
So that was Anne-Marie with One Thing, a classic to kind of pump you up. You said this is the song that you use to kind of finish these notes that you're working on. And actually, an example of a note you brought to my attention was this small modular nuclear power plant.
Yeah, yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about that? Tell us what's going on.
So small modular nuclear reactors, or SMRs as they're known for short. So, I mean, these are a bit of technology that have... been kind of on the radar for, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 years now. And I mean, in a nutshell, they are just small versions of nuclear power plants. So nuclear power plants, so we have like Hinkley C that's being built in the southwest of England, for example, is a very large, you know, nuclear power plants are large and complex and very costly as well. And for a number of reasons, parts of industry and academics and increasingly government are fixing their attention on these SMRs for a number of reasons. They have a potential number of benefits compared to this conventional nuclear power generation. So, well, for one, I mean, it's kind of said that if you have a smaller nuclear reactor, then it overcomes some of the kind of financing costs. You know, it's not as financially risky maybe as these giant nuclear power stations. there is some, you know, discussion about potentially being able to use them more, I say, flexibly than a conventional nuclear plant. So when I say flexibly, I mean, so if you imagine that electricity demand goes up and down throughout the day, right? And conventionally with nuclear, what you do is you just run your nuclear power station as what's called base load. So you just run it at constant output. You get as much as you can out of it at all times as possible. And that's to take advantage of some of the economic kind of aspects of nuclear power. But increasingly, you know, we have more, we're moving towards this more flexible electricity system. So demand's kind of changing a little bit, but supply is changing quite a lot. So we have a lot of like renewable generation, for example, which is intermittent. And so what you're getting is this supply and demand is getting maybe a little bit more difficult to match. And so a lot of people talk about using SMRs in a more flexible electricity system, which is, you know, another potential use for it. But, you know, the challenges around the SMRs are that none have been built yet, really. So, yeah. I mean, you know, okay, there were small nuclear power stations back in like the 50s and 60s, and you know, there are nuclear power submarines which are small, but none have really been put into the electricity grid, as it were. And there are kind of, so there are some of these SMRs which are maybe 5 or 10 years away, which are based on kind of smaller versions of existing technology, and then there are these more maybe exotic kind of what are often termed advanced modular reactors. Mm.
Is there a particular topic that you, I mean, you've only been working there for what, now 18 months? So
thereabouts, 14 months,
so
yeah.
So is there any, and policy, I'm guessing, moves at a very slowly, these kind of, you're talking about 5-10 year timescales, this kind of thing. But are there any things that you've, or topics that you feel like you've influenced decision making and things like that within Parliament, yeah, even if it's in a small group? Is that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And it's a little bit tricky as well, because, so kind of the purpose, if you will, of these post notes is just to give members often like a foundational level of knowledge on a particular topic. So they might download and read one of the post notes, but they rarely actually mention them. So it's difficult for us to get feedback, for one. But, you know, sometimes in like the chamber, for example, the House of Commons chamber, you know, the green benches, someone will stand up, a member will stand up and say, oh, this post note says this, da-da-da. And that's obviously great. We love to hear that. But then sort of outside of the post notes themselves, you know, we do host kind of a lot of events. We do put academics in touch with members. And so we kind of have that other role as well of like linking academic and policymaking expertise, which is maybe a bit more immediate and tangible, some of those impacts. Yeah, so, you know, it's a mixed bag, really.
Yeah, so these notes aren't the only way that you're giving output. You're allowing, you know, academics to talk to politicians and stuff. Yeah. And I've been to certain things like this, you know, at the Palace of Westminster as well, you know, talking to people, trying to talk to politicians on new technologies. And that really is a way of, you know, getting people up to speed and stuff like that. So we're going to move on to your next song. We've got Love You to Death by Typo Negative.
Yeah, so this one's... this one's a bit off the wall. Many listeners might not be familiar with Typo Negative, but they are one of these bands that they kind of reach across many different audiences. So, you know, they've got fans who are your old school, like, you know, your old school goths and your metalheads, but then they also appeal largely to, you know, people who are into their really synth-heavy 90s pop kind of thing. And also just really love the dulcet tones of the late and great Peter Steele, their frontman. So... yeah, this is Love You to Death. It was a tricky one choosing this track because, you know, there are maybe 4 or 5 different songs I could play, but it turns out they're maybe not that radio friendly. They're a little bit risque.
That's okay. We're pretty risque on Soho Radio. Here it is, and this is Typo Negative with Love You to Death.
Thank you.
that was a typo negative with love you to death. Right, it's time for some science news. Ooh. So we've had a look to kind of see what kind of science news that we found this week. So I've got something on how Einstein was right all along. Mm. And you said you picked up something on this heat wave
This heat wave that we're having in a kind of study that's been come out today, or come out in the last couple of days at least, about kind of the likelihood of the heat wave with the effects of climate change and without.
All right, as in, like, is this caused by climate change?
Yeah, or? Right, okay. So, Northern Europe is undergoing this massive heat wave at the minute, right? The Arctic is on fire. There's, like, 30-odd wildfires in the Arctic. And, you know, this study, I should caveat right up front, okay, it's a rapid assessment, it's not peer-reviewed, and it was written quite quickly, and, you know, the results are quite preliminary because summer's not over yet, right? But so that aside, the World Weather Attribution Research Consortium have done this study, and it's basically saying that this heat wave in Northern Europe is more than twice as likely with the effects of climate change than without. And I thought it was quite an interesting...
Right, that's quite a big margin, man. Twice as likely.
Twice as likely, yeah. And I think the interesting thing about it is this language around kind of probability, right? And it's... I just wanted to pick it up because, you know... So it's one of the things when you're talking about climate change and you're trying to attribute extreme weather events to climate change. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, the climate's an insanely complex model. And it gets into this kind of difference between what's weather and what's climate. So weather is essentially, you know, it's what's happening. It's a localized weather on the timescale of kind of maybe seconds or hours or days. But then climate and the way climate changes is much more like a decadal kind of process. So it's really difficult to attribute weather to climate. And so I think I just wanted to kind of pull this out, really, because it's, you know, it's an interesting one. This kind of attribution science, as it's called, is moving quite quickly.
Yeah, there is this kind of distinction that people tend to have. And I heard that the kind of reason for the weather is this pool of cool water off of the coast of the Arctic.
Yeah, I mean, that would make sense. That would...
Something that's diverting. So maybe that's it.
Well, there was a lot of stuff about, you know, you've got the there's the polar vortex as well, which is kind of this, you can imagine it as this giant cold cap on the Earth, right, within the atmosphere of cold air. Mm. And it's what keeps the North Pole cold and everything below it relatively warm. It kind of traps in all that cold. And that seems to, from what I know, I mean, I'm not a climate scientist, but from what I know, that's gone a bit mental recently, you could
that's
say.
That's a technical term.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I think, part of that was related to, you know, we had the Beast from the East earlier this year as well. So, yeah, it's all changing the Arctic. It's getting pretty hot.
It's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. So the other thing I found was this week that there were some recent measurements made on a star that's orbiting a black hole that showed the effects predicted by Einstein over 100 years ago were correct. And this is scientists working on the Very Large Telescope in Chile, and they measured the redshift of a star, which is called S2, and it made its closest approach.
What a great name.
Yeah, I know. Really creative name, right? But this S2 star was making its very its close approach to the supermassive black hole that's at the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way. And this redshift is the change in the frequency of light that's emitted from the star due to the fact that it emits it in a strong gravitational field. And this is an effect that was predicted by Einstein. It's to do with general relativity. And this is just an idea of that this general relativity has now passed another test and is really... cementing its position in the center of scientific thought. Yeah. And it's not, you know, entirely, you know, out of this world, because general relativistic corrections are made in your phone.
Yeah.
And they account for the effect of GPS signals at different gravitational fields. And actually, that's how GPS can be made so accurate.
Yeah.
It needs these general relativistic corrections for it to be done.
Absolutely. And I think it's so... I mean, Einstein, well, he's Einstein, isn't he? He was a bleeding genius. And this was his general theory of general relativity was, what, in the 1920s, I think it was?
Yeah.
And, you know, he predicted this. They didn't have computers at the time. It was just him and a pen, essentially. And you know, and his theory is only being proven, or the evidence is only starting to amass to prove his theories 100 years later or so. And,
exactly.
You know, and he was so prescient for his time. And it's interesting. I think one of the interesting things about this as well is the fact that, you know, we are already... You don't need that kind of theoretical proof. You don't need to have the proofs on the paper, but we just know that it's right?
Yeah.
Because we're doing these GPS and these mobile kind of calculations. You know, it's a very well understood part of physics.
It's a good model, right?
All
models are wrong, but some are useful.
Well, this is particularly useful.
So the other thing I found, actually, this is quite interesting research that's been done at MIT. And this is like nanocircuits in a can, which I will now explain. So they've developed these two-dimensional polymer electronic chips that are very small. They're only the width of a human hair, and they contain within them a photodiode and a chemical detector. And so this chip is so small that it can actually be contained in an aerosol. So you can release it into an environment just in like a deodorant can or something like that. And the idea is...
It sounds pretty menacing, doesn't it?
it does, but this is the amazing thing. So it's released into the environment, and then at the moment, what they have to do is collect them later and then analyze them to see if the circuit came into contact with a specific chemical. And the current designs can detect, I think, ammonia and soot. But future iterations, they could be made to kind of emit light if you see something present. Or they analyze, a host of chemicals and then have some electronic communication to something else. And what this makes me think of is these opening up to the new nanotechnologies that can go places that are inaccessible to big humans. I'm talking things like your bloodstream. You know, you can inject yourself with these circuits. They light up when they reach a particular place where something is gone wrong, and then you can go in and selectively reduce things like this. Maybe we're not that far off having these little nanobots in your body.
It's mental, isn't it? I think nanotech is just a little bit mind-blowing, and like you say, like a little bit scary as well, like how small these things are getting. But the potential applications are just vast, and
lots and lots more nanotech stuff to come. And we're going to move on to the next song, and you've chosen Trifex with UK Apache with Original Nutter.
Yeah, so this
slightly
is...
slightly different again.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, I mean, the last one was quite slow, it was quite long. I thought I'd, inject a bit of energy into the mix. And this one really is a shout-out to London. This is my hometown. This song has quite a strong link with London. And I first heard this tune on the way to Notting Hill Carnival, I think, like many years ago. It doesn't really need much of an introduction. It's a bit of old school jungle, and
here we go.
Spin it.
You never know you can watch it. Big in a jungle. Women tell everybody, watch it, no man. Me at the nutter, original man, my nutter.
Brilliant. So, Jack, we're talking about doing these post notes. You're communicating with scientists. You're talking to politicians. What do you think needs to happen? Should MPs be more scientifically informed, or should scientists be better at communicating their research?
Should MPs be more scientifically informed? Well, if we're doing our jobs properly, then no. Hopefully not. It's a tricky one, right? Like, so you've got this meeting of, you've got two different groups that are trying to talk to each other. MPs, so members of the UK Parliament, like I said, you know, often they have a non-technical background, and a lot of people kind of bemoan the lack of STEM subjects that members have studied before. It's a tricky one, right? So members have to make policy decisions, And you can argue, yes, well, policy does need to be underpinned by sound scientific evidence or evidence in general, whether that's scientific or more kind of broadly social science or natural science or whatever. But at the end of the day, policy decisions are often made. You know, you might have two policy decisions and the science might be uncertain, or it's, you know, like I said, it's real life is complex, right? You can't just let science decide everything because of these uncertainties. And so often they'll come with a kind of a normative decision, right? So based on like values and judgments and these kind of things. So there is, the science can take you up to a point, and our job really is to try and, you know, make sure that that scientific foundation is there. In terms of, well, should academics be better at communicating their research? Well, at risk of offending all academics, sometimes the writing can, you know, or communication can be a bit tricky. Right, okay, fair enough. You know, a lot of research scientists are looking at very, very complex issues, very technical issues, and it's fair enough that sometimes the research is a little bit opaque. That said, you know, maybe sometimes they can be a bit better at learning to communicate. You know, what does what I'm researching actually mean in reality, as it were? But it's a tricky one, right? So, you know, a lot of the time, scientists are looking at, you know, science is like a mosaic, right? So you might be looking at one very, very small piece of a bigger picture. And it is difficult sometimes to get kind of real world policy impacts out of your research. And so it's kind of fair enough, really. But and that's, I suppose that's kind of where bodies like POST or, you know, even like the Royal Society and the learned societies, the academies, the institutions, where you can really consolidate that knowledge, if you will, and then start to try and tease out what the policy implications are, and how they do affect, you know, real world. Because, you know, the pursuit of scientific knowledge is a noble and just cause and should be done in itself. But, you know, at the end of the day, we do often, you know, a lot of it's there's public funding involved, so we do want some policy kind of outputs from it.
I mean, at the end of the day, we're doing the science to better understand the world, to make improvements, and maybe we should remember that occasionally. We're not going to do it too well, though, because otherwise you'll be out of a job. So how can people get involved? Where can they find kind of the POST notes?
So
find a bit more, maybe a bit more about you?
Well, I mean, all of the POST notes are publicly available. They're not just consumed by members, they're consumed widely across industry and the public and all these other organisations, and they're available on our website, which I can't remember the URL, but if you just search POST Parliament or something like that, then it'll come up and you'll be able to find the POST notes. How can you get involved? Well, okay, it depends what you do, right? So if you're a PhD student, I would, and this is something that you might potentially be interested in, I'd really recommend looking at our fellowships, right? So I mentioned these earlier, so we have PhD students come and work with us for 3 months, researching and writing under the supervision of an advisor, one of these POST notes. And we have various fellowship schemes. It depends upon where you are in your fellowship, in your PhD, sorry, and who your PhD is funded by. But if you have a look at the fellowships and check eligibility, you can basically come and work with us for 3 months. Or sometimes, you know, we might place a fellow with a select committee for 3 months as well, so they might be supporting them or one of the libraries or something. And generally, well, when I was doing my PhD, I applied for one of these fellowships and I went, well, it's a post-fellowship, but I went to the National Assembly for Wales Research Service, so it's, you know, a joint kind of fellowship. And I found it really valuable. I know, I'd say the majority, if not all of our fellows, find them to be a very valuable experience because it takes you out of your day-to-day, you know, your PhD, which, you know, let's face it, can be a real slog sometimes. You know, you've got this 3-4 year task ahead of you, and it's you know, it could be quite valuable to be taken out of that and look at either one topic or a number of different topics if you're with a select committee, which might not necessarily be related to your PhD. If you are a if you are maybe further developed in your research career and you want to get your expertise into Parliament more generally, well, you can get in touch with us. You know, we have a list of all of the post notes that we're currently working on and plan on working on our website as well. And we welcome being approached by academics. You know, if you see something that you have an expertise in and you think you might be able to contribute, then please do get in touch. Our website's on the address as well.
Brilliant. I mean, that's great. Thanks so much. And I just have to thank you again for coming in.
Oh, thanks.
It's nice
much,
to have
Bill.
A kind of different aspect of science. Yeah, thank you, Jack Miller. Remember, you can listen again to any of the shows in podcast form and get in touch with @ScienceMixtape. Just let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you. So for our last song, I think maybe you might just be able to kind of start hearing it, but you've picked a Black Sabbath track.
Yeah, so I mean... I had to include Black Sabbath. They're one of the most, well, they're such an influential band. You know, they go back really far. Without them, half the bands that I listen to wouldn't exist. They're like the fathers of heavy metal. This is off the second album, Paranoid, released in 1970. And I should probably give some kind of like political disclaimer here about the political opinions expressed within this song, but that's not very rock and roll, is it? So let's just play it. This is War Pigs.
Well, thank you and goodbye.
Masses, just like witches at black masses, evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction.